This is MSCI Perspectives, bringing to light insights and analysis that help global investors solve today's challenges. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is April 10th, 2025. Now, I don't know about you, but the phrase, "May you live in interesting times," has been rolling around in my head a lot lately, along with words like tariffs and supply chains. Frankly, it's hard to just keep up. Let me give you an example. As we were sitting down to record this, Joe and I got word that there was going to be a 90-day pause on some of the tariffs that are out there. The conversation we're going to play for you today from Ashley Lester and his quarterly roundtable of experts was recorded before the first round of tariffs on April 2nd. That conversation, however, is still very relevant today. Here is that conversation. I'll see you on the other side.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to the MSCI Perspectives Quarterly Roundtable, where MSCI research experts discuss the biggest investment questions of the day. I'm Ashley Lester, the Chief Research Officer at MSCI, and your host for our discussion today. 3 months ago, our overriding theme was the dominance of the US in the world's financial markets. In 2024, US public equity markets outperformed European markets by more than 20 percentage points. The Magnificent Seven continued their magnificent dominance of global equity markets and indeed became even more aggressively priced over the course of 2024, even controlling for their already very strongly stated growth prospects. However, 3 months ago, there were already some uncertainties on the horizon. Were AI stocks too aggressively valued? Would the incoming Trump administration act on its tariff promises? And if so, what would the effect be? So far this year, in just these past 3 months, we have seen quite astounding action on both the policy front and in financial markets. While public markets continue to change rapidly, as of our recording day, the MSCI Europe Index has outperformed MSCI US by nearly 16 percentage points year to date. That is, it's erased almost all of its relative losses compared to the US over the course of that incredibly strong run that US markets experienced in 2024. Meanwhile, US 10-year rates have fallen significantly through February and March, while European and Japanese rates, of all things, have continued generally to rise. And consistent with this, the previously unstoppable US dollar has retreated from its highs of late 2024. Today, to discuss these and many more issues with me, I have, as always, an outstanding panel of MSCI researchers. Chenlu Zhou is a researcher in our analytics group and an expert in modeling the interaction between financial markets and macroeconomics. Abhishek Gupta is a researcher in our equity investing team and has recently published research analyzing the extent to which individual stocks are exposed to tariffs, amongst other topics. Laura Nishikawa also rejoins us. Laura is the head of sustainability and climate research at MSCI. Chenlu, I would like to start with you. I've already mentioned the changes we've seen in US financial markets and markets more broadly this year. Roughly speaking, how would you describe the change in outlook that we've seen so far this year?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me here, Ashley. In a nutshell, I think the economic outlook for the first quarter is that we're really seeing this renewal of supply shocks and stagflation risks in response to the tariff. So, for example, Fed had come out last week citing tariff concerns as one of the main reasons for their revision of economic projections for 2025. To put some numbers on it, they are adjusting the forecast for growth from 2.1% to 1.7%. And then they're increasing their inflation projections for 2025 from 2.5% to 2.8%. Supply shocks are really putting Fed in a bind in their policy response to growth and inflation concerns. So should they lower interest rate to battle recession concern, or should they increase interest rate to fight inflation? And as a result, they have really slowed their pace of the rate cuts. A data point that we've been observing is the slope of the yield curve. So we're seeing the 10-year yield going down. So in fact, as we look at the slope of the yield curve of the term structure, From 10 year minus 3 months, we saw that number barely made into positive territory in December after 2 years being in the negatives. And they reached a high point in mid-January, and now they're back negative again. So that's on the economic outlook side. And what are the implications of that in financial markets? I think there are several angles we can look at this. One is more structurally. In general, we see supply-driven inflation typically poses a greater challenge to the investors than a demand-driven inflation. And this is related back to what I mentioned earlier about this policy dilemma. And then what that manifests itself in the markets is the bond equity correlation tend to be more positive in a supply-driven inflation environment compared to a demand-driven one. And from an investor's perspective, their multi-asset class portfolio with bond and equity are less hedging, provides less hedging for each other. So that's on the structural side. And the other thing we can look at is the sentiment of the market. Even though the long-term impact of tariff is still less clear than the short-term impact at this point, we do see the shift in market sentiment and putting an upward pressure on the equity risk premium, which is a very important driver of market volatility.
Just to be clear for our listeners, when you're talking about an equity risk premium is like the inverse of an equity price, right? So the equity risk premium is low when equity prices are high and therefore expected returns are low, right?
Yeah, so equity risk premium is the inverse of price. When price go up, equity risk premium tend to go down and vice versa. And in fact, as we see in the US equity market, the forward-looking ERP, according to our model, which reflects the expected return needed to reconcile the market price given the macro fundamental, was at a 20-year low as of December. That brings me to my other final point on the market impact, which is mean reversion of this valuation gap between the rest of the world and the U.S. In the last decade, even we have this discussion about American exceptionalism in the stock market. And as a result of that, we're seeing this forward-looking equity risk premium measure of the rest of the world compared to the U.S., the gap of it has reached a 25-year high, and that means it's ripe for mean reversion.
Wow. So 25 years, this is kind of harking back to the relative valuation of U.S. equities compared to the rest of the world as it was during the height of the first dot-com boom in the late 90s. Now, I think we should stress to our listeners here that valuation signals, that there's an extensive discussion about valuation signals and their usefulness in investing. But I think a headline point for us to make is that we would recommend that investors never take valuation signals in themselves as the basis for an investment strategy. I think it's worth kind of highlighting that up front. I want to go to explore another point in what you were talking about, Chenlu, which is in a lot of financial market commentary, we hear commentary about the economy and financial markets kind of side by side, as though financial markets are sort of the exact mirror image or an exact reflection of what's going on in the real economy. Paul Samuelson, one of the founders of modern economics and one of my personal heroes, said in 1982 that the stock market had predicted 9 out of the last 5 recessions. And that suggests maybe the link between financial markets and economics isn't quite as tight as those of us who are financial and economic commentators might sometimes imply. Can you tell us what the evidence is there based on the kind of modeling which you've been doing?
Yeah, I would say the stock market is not the real economy, like the joke that you just pointed out. But what I would say is that the environment, in the environment where the valuation is so high and when people have a lot of gains already on their books, there's a lot of pressure for that valuation to go down. And sometimes for that to happen, you really just need some kind of economic catalyst to kind of cause people to scare and pull away their investment. And then that's what I would say we're seeing potentially in the Q1 is the concern of tariffs is playing this role of a trigger for that market sell-off.
Can you tell us a little more then about what goes into these valuation metrics which you were describing? What goes into thinking about the equity risk premium?
For sure. Yeah, so there are many traditional valuation measures people look at in the market. So there's the PE ratio, or they look at cyclical adjusted version of the PE ratio. Actually, back in 2022, when we first look at the market when it was really highly valued already at the point, if you look at the PE ratio then, it almost looked as expensive as things were, say, 2000 at the top of the dot-com bubble. But what was really different in 2022 versus 2000 is that the real interest rate was actually much lower compared to 20 years ago. So our valuation measure, this forward-looking ERP, really takes into account not just how much price to earning looks like, but also what the rate environment is, what the forward-looking growth projections are. So combining this together to provide a more accurate projection of what the risk premium component is being demanded by the market.
I see. Because intuitively speaking, when rates were low, you might as well buy stocks because you weren't going to get anything out of bonds anyway. Now the rates are higher, there's a more attractive alternative. I see. That's very interesting and helpful. Thank you, Chenlu. Now, the model that you've been describing, as I understand it, operates mainly at kind of the level of the macroeconomy and the overall stock market, like the MSCI USA or MSCI World. But of course, much of the interest in financial markets, very much including the stock market, is in what's going on beneath the aggregate level. Which types of stocks are winning or losing? And at this point, I'd like to ask Abhishek to join the conversation and to describe to us, over the first quarter, as we've been seeing these tumultuous shifts in stock market leadership at the national level, what's been going on at the other types of levels of stock markets which we were able to analyze?
There has been a significant amount of rotation in market leadership across countries, sectors, and factors. We've discussed some of the country stuff already. So for instance, you know, U.S. equities have actually been one of the worst performing major markets since the beginning of this year. But some of the other markets, such as Europe and China, they have actually come out of long periods of dormancy, and they happen to be some of the best performing markets this year. But at the same time, there is also significant rotation that have happened at a sector level. So We are all aware of the major sell-off that has happened in technology over the last 3 months. But what is something that may have been a little obscured is really the underperformance of the consumer discretionary sector. So given that, you know, we are heading into an environment where growth is a little more challenged, inflation is a bit more concerning, so it is quite possible that consumers are scaling back on their expenditures, which is really putting a negative outlook on the consumer discretionary sector. The sectors that have actually done quite well are really the old economy groups, such as energy, financials, and materials. Interesting insights can also be drawn when we look at it from a factor perspective. The last several years has really favored trend-following strategies such as momentum. But what we are now seeing is a bit of a reversal, and with this renewed focus on fundamentals, as well as you know, this risk of mindset that investors have, we are seeing significant gains come through in strategies such as low volatility, as well as value. The only other factor that I would call out is the crowding factor, which has seen steep declines over the past 6 months. What a crowding factor essentially is that it is tracking the performance of the overcrowded stocks relative to the undercrowded stocks. And so if you're seeing a steep decline in the performance of the crowding factor, it essentially means that companies that were overowned or overbought are now being sold. And this clearly shows that there is a shift in investor preference which again points back to the same overall theme of the market rotation that we're seeing.
I see. So before this year, you almost couldn't be too popular and too crowded. Everyone wanted to go to Times Square or Leicester Square together and buy the same stocks everyone else was buying, whereas now people are heading out sort of to the outer zones, are they?
Yes, absolutely. You can think of this as investors, they're trying to unwind their crowded positions. The crowded stocks, they don't appear to be popular as much anymore, because when markets are actually going through periods of turmoil, because of panic selling, it is quite possible that the crowd stocks, they sell a lot more than some of the other ones.
I see. Now, that's very interesting. This sector rotation that you're describing is also interesting, away from a sector like consumer discretionary towards perhaps sectors like financials or energy. Something that occurs to me perhaps about some of those sectors might be, and you can correct me if I've got this wrong, but might be that some of those sectors which are doing relatively better are relatively less exposed to international trade in goods. And I'm sure you're with me on where I'm going on this. The word on everyone's lips these days is tariffs. What can we say about what types of stocks are most exposed to increased tariffs, whether from the US or perhaps as a result of a tariff war? What types of stocks are most exposed, and is there any evidence that those stocks have been doing more poorly?
So tariffs have the potential to disrupt a significant proportion of global commerce. We used the MSCI economic exposure data, which essentially maps out company revenues to end markets. And what we found was that roughly 40% of the global corporate revenue is earned in international markets. And 18% of this is actually exposed to tariffs and potential counter tariffs. And this is almost evenly split between non-US firms that are selling into the US and US firms that are selling internationally. Now, this is, of course, like metadata, and we can now go down a little deeper because the information is actually available at a company level. But what we find is that there are certain countries and industries that are heavily exposed. So, for instance, you have countries such as Canada, Germany, Japan, UK, China. They all derive a significant proportion of their corporate revenues from the US market. In terms of industries, automobiles, capital goods, materials, technology, hardware, they are all heavily exposed. We also see growing signs of tariff risk being reflected in global equity markets. So for instance, if you take the example of the auto industry, which has been so much under the scanner, we are seeing that the auto stocks within Europe, US, and Japan, they're all down quite significantly since the end of last year. But in contrast, you see that there are Chinese auto companies that are doing pretty well. They've actually outperformed the broader market. And that may be because of the fact that many of these Chinese companies, they actually have low exposure to the US market. So we can clearly see how revenue exposures are kind of shaping market outcomes. Now, I do want to point out that this is not something that has always played out. So just to give an example, once again, going back to autos, Canadian autos are heavily exposed to the US, and they make up a major share of the Canadian export economy. However, Canadian autos have a very small representation within the Canadian listed equities. So as a consequence of this, what could potentially happen is that even though tariffs will have a significant impact on the Canadian economy at large, we have not really started to see that translate into the performance of the Canadian equity market. So sometimes you might see through tariffs that, yes, there are these direct effects, and you see in terms of performance what you expect, but sometimes things can be a little more convoluted. But now I want to pivot to another point, which is that while revenue exposures are important, they may not really be sufficient when you are trying to assess the impact of tariffs. So just to give you an example, let's say if there are Japanese automakers that are producing goods in Mexico, then they might be heavily exposed to higher Mexican tariffs compared to those Japanese manufacturers that are producing goods domestically in Japan and then exporting into the US. So what we really need is some sort of a granular lens on the corporate supply chain of companies. And so to be able to address that, what we have done is that we have used, we've combined two different data sets. One is the economic exposure, and the second is the geospatial data that we have. So this is a MSCI proprietary data set. And what it essentially is that it has information on the physical assets that are owned or operated by public companies. We have a lot of information, a lot of different fields in there, such as, you know, what are the geographic coordinates of these assets? What are the type of activities that are carried out in these facilities? Is it a manufacturing hub? Is it a warehousing center? And so by using this information, as well as the economic exposure information, investors can essentially do an assessment of which firms are going to be most exposed with a higher degree of confidence and higher degree of accuracy.
So that's fascinating, Abhishek. It sounds like there's vast amounts of work to do here for investors, or indeed for real-world companies, in figuring out the implications of potentially this very complex set of new policies. What it reminds me of, as we enter this world where geography kind of plays an important role again, is a little bit that this phrase, which ended all of our vocabularies around the time of kind of the recovery from the pandemic, when everyone suddenly learned all about supply chains and the real world consequences of having difficult or extended supply chains. There are researchers at MSCI who have been studying supply chains and their consequences and implications for years. And those researchers work within our sustainability research team. Laura, can you tell us a bit about the sorts of insights which we generate from looking at supply chains systematically?
Yeah, we've been looking at supply chains for quite a long time in the sustainability part of our research. It's a critical vector through which sustainability risks affect companies. And so we've done a lot to look at how companies are managing supply chain resilience and so forth. And I think this is just one other example of how something that maybe was more interesting to sustainability-oriented investors once upon a time is now much more relevant to any investor, regardless of their objectives. Similar to the geospatial data that Abhishek mentioned, that's data that we collected in order to measure exposure to physical climate risks, but the way it's being used to measure exposure to tariffs, to geopolitical, but also macroeconomic, or even other logistical shocks to supply chains is something that is been emerging among our clients, and we're seeing a significant surge in interest from our clients on that topic.
In general, I guess what clients are trying to deal with is this surge in uncertainty, and indeed, perhaps the uncertainty itself is causing some of the changes that we're seeing in financial markets. Is there any way of capturing that sort of uncertainty insight systematically in a macroeconomic, macro-financial model, generally?
Yeah, I was going to add, too, when we were having this discussion, that uncertainty has really been a key theme in the macro discussion so far this year. I think there are a couple ways that I like to think about uncertainty. In macro modeling, we often talk about volatility versus risk. Volatility is what had realized. And then if you look back, things may look smooth, but the uncertainty at each point in time is what the real risk is at. One thing we tend to look at, we tend to think about, is how the uncertainty about the future inflation tend to be what's really driving the inflation. So this inflation is a self-fulfilling prophecy kind of idea. Another thing that we've seen as kind of macro and market is how uncertainty is hurting, you know, private market deal making. People are unsure about the future of deal exit and then how they will perform in the public market. So less deal making, less cash flow, less liquidity. One thing also that reminds me is this discussion around the macro impact on small cap stocks, which I thought was interesting. So a couple months ago, there's this kind of conventional wisdom of tariffs might be good for small cap because the U.S. small cap are more domestically focused and they might benefit from it. They had a lower valuation compared to large cap. But so far, that has not been true. The small cap actually fared worse than the large cap in the first quarter, and largely due to uncertainty, because people like Abhishek was mentioning earlier, consumers are pulling back and people are wait and see. So definitely, I think uncertainty is a key theme people should pay attention to.
Regular listeners may remember that we often talk about private equity and private assets on this podcast, and that as of 3 months ago, there was quite a lot of excitement in markets that many of the private equity deals in particular, which have been locked up for quite a long time now, might finally actually be done, both in terms of old investments getting sold off to realize profits for the end investors and perhaps for new investments to be made. I think it's fair to say at this stage, it's hard to see much evidence that that anticipated boom is really working out in deal making. And you can see that to some extent also in the prices of listed investment banks. So the uncertainty is having a real world effect on, or seems to be having a real world effect on, this much needed kind of increase in deal making in the heretofore rapidly growing areas of private equity, including venture capital and buyout. And just as a reminder, those areas are seeing distributions to their end investors at about 20% of the rate that they normally distribute cash back to their end investors. So if you're a pension fund, you're counting on getting some money back from your big private capital investment to help pay out the pensions that you need to pay out, you're only getting back about a fifth of what you're expecting to get back. That might start to hurt over the coming year or so, if indeed it hasn't already been hurting already.
Just add real quickly to that. One thing we've seen, that because of that lack of distribution, pension funds are also less willing or more resistant in committing new capital. So that could have a longer term impact that we don't really know yet.
Right. And if that itself slows down investment in the economy, then the long term sort of potential growth rate of the economy might be slowed as well. Another really important area which is very affected by policy uncertainty is the transition to a low-carbon economy. Obviously, the new United States administration has fairly different policy priorities there compared to the previous administration. And one might imagine that might be having some effects on transition investments. What's going on in the world of transition investments, Laura?
Yeah, I want to come back to that topic of uncertainty and policy uncertainty, because I think that is really the key word when it comes to the energy transition. A lot has been made about the cooling off of climate policy in the U.S., but also globally, potentially, as countries need to shift focus to other really pressing macroeconomic or geopolitical matters. I think what's really interesting, and this came through in a number of client conversations we've had recently, including some of our client advisory work, is that increasing uncertainty, just as Chenlu says, means increasing risk. So cooling, more uncertainty around the energy transition actually increases transition risk. It doesn't decrease transition risk. And what do I mean by that? You know, we've seen interest from our clients in transition risk and in also the opportunities that the dislocations associated with the energy transition pose across all the regions, including in the U.S., where we hear a lot about this policy uncertainty and a lot about, the rolling back of subsidies and policies and pulling out of the climate Paris Accords, for example. I think a couple of reasons why we think that energy transition is still critically important to understand, but maybe requires more nuance to understand it, tie back to basically what Abhishek was talking about with regional fragmentation and trade. In our paper earlier this year, we talked about how the center of gravity around energy transition has been shifting already ahead of this administration from west to east. You know, Asia is on track to consume as much energy as the rest of the world combined. China is leading the charge on solar, wind, and EVs. A number of members of my team were just in mainland China last week, and there seemed to be increasing momentum around really doubling down on the energy transition. That's already affecting supply chains. That's already affecting trade tensions. It's not just an energy story either. It's about industrial policy. It's about competitiveness. And it's not even just about climate in that sense, right? It's about energy security. And that's another thing I wanted to really point out in this world where trade is being disrupted and where regionalization is occurring. We might actually see other drivers of the energy transition emerge as more important, perhaps in the short term, than even the climate objectives of moving from high emitting sources of energy to low emitting sources of energy. I think the trade disruptions and the tensions create an imperative for countries to create a stable, localized, diversified energy mix. That's equally true of Europe, which needs to, you know, of course, reduce reliance on Russia. It's true in Asia. It's true in the U.S., where, you know, the U.S. is already energy independent, but it needs to meet the rising demand coming from the very, very thirsty data centers and AI expansion plans here to meet those locally through stable sources of energy. So we see other drivers of the energy transition, and, you know, it remains to be seen, but that might actually do more to move the world towards away from fossil fuels or towards at least lower carbon emitting energy sources than climate policy itself. So climate policy isn't the be-all end-all. It's not the only reason why we see the shift to energy transition. But the uncertainty that you point out makes the question of capital allocation much more difficult. It's not as simple as saying there will be a global price on carbon. We can just take all the high-emitting companies, price that immediately. It's much more complex. It matters much more where companies operate, in what industries, in what technologies, what policies they're exposed to, what is the commercial viability of the low carbon technologies in their space, and what are the cost dynamics of substitutes. So it's become a much more nuanced question for investors who really want to navigate this, navigate the both the risks and also the opportunities that the energy transition creates.
Right. And that that sounds quite similar to the theme that Abhishek was exploring earlier. In a world where we deglobalize and pursue a set of more discretionary and regional policies, that the investment analyst's task just innately becomes more complicated and more nuanced, whether it's looking to more sophisticated sets of data to figure out which companies are going to be affected in what way by trade. Or in your example, Laura, you know, what are the actual underlying drivers of kind of a thesis for investment in one company versus the other with respect to its exposure to transition risk? As you were talking, actually, your discussion reminded me of a law of conservation of investment in climate change. So this is a brand new law, so bear with me. But the idea is essentially, look, to the extent that the transition to lower carbon energy sources is slowed and that there's therefore less investment in it, the sad but cold hard fact of it is that there is going to be worse real-world climate outcomes. Avoiding those was meant to be a big part of the reason why we were seeking to transition. So there will be more fires comparable to those that we saw in Los Angeles, or hurricanes comparable to those that we saw on the east coast of the US, and those will impose real-world costs on companies. And so if companies aren't going to be investing as, or the world isn't going to be investing as much in transitioning as quickly as it was going to before, it feels like there's going to have to be investment in mitigation, or investors are going to have to invest in trying to figure out which companies are most exposed to these sources of physical risk that unfortunately are only going to be amplified over the years to come.
Yeah, maybe two quick points. So one is, you know, I'm not sure that the world is going to be investing less in the transitioning to a low carbon economy. To the extent that climate goals overlap with energy security goals, which overlap with economic goals, as we see the costs of many of these technologies, you know, lowering dramatically, we can actually see more investment. And we do see a shift and some evidence of flows towards, you know, more and more transition, real world transition investments, especially in private markets. But I think what you say is totally true. It will by no means be, in any world that I can see, sufficient to mitigate or delay the largest consequences of climate change. And so if you think about how we looked at climate investing or climate risk, you know, 5 years ago, it was very much an either or. Either you have a very fast transition and it creates a lot of economic disruption and there's a lot of transition risk, or you don't transition at all and you have a lot of physical risk. And I think the situation we found ourselves in right now is it's going to be both. There's going to be a lot of regionalized transition risk, Also opportunities for, you know, investors and active managers that can find those maybe less obvious opportunities within there. So, for example, you know, we've all know about how the macro environment has been difficult or challenging, right, for the renewable sector. But we see, you know, very strong performance among miners of critical minerals, for example, right? So there are less obvious winners and losers within the transition. But you're totally right that the salience and importance of physical risks becomes even more important. And that is very much where, going back to kind of the earlier conversation, the location of assets matters enormously. And the resilience of supply chains matters enormously. And also, I think something else that's become very, very clear, I hope, to everyone in these last couple of years, at least it feels like it has in the U.S., is that this is not a kind of a 100-year time horizon question, right? These events are happening right now. There are challenges and changes happening, you know, very much within the realm, especially of, you know, private investments in longer lived assets, but even in terms of the time horizon of the average investor.
Thank you, Laura. Perhaps that's kind of a theme we can take away from our discussion of this quarter, which is that we are seeing around us all sorts of changes in the world, from policy changes through real-world climate changes, through kind of international financial framework changes, which perhaps we would never have expected to see, or certainly not have expected to see in such a short and compressed amount of time as we've been seeing them in the first quarter of 2025. I think this has been a fascinating discussion, exploring these sorts of changes at all levels, from the level of macroeconomics and changes in macroeconomic expectations to a really granular level of kind of the actual physical locations, for instance, of public companies, as we've discussed with Abhishek and Laura. I feel like we could keep talking for hours, as always, but once again, we find ourselves out of time. And so I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you very much, Chen Lu, Abhishek and Laura, for all your insights today. An even bigger thank you to our listeners. To our listeners, I would say this: we would love to hear your thoughts on our discussion and on what we should discuss next time. We've set up an email address for you to email us at, which is perspectivespodcast@msci.com. So please drop us a line at perspectivespodcast@msci.com. And if you do, we'll try to make sure that we address your comments in our next episode. Until then, this is Ashley Lester wishing you success in dealing with the tumultuous months to come.
That's all for this week. Our thanks to Ashley, Chen Lu, Abhishek, and Laura, and of course, to all of you for listening. Now, I can't tell you what's happened since this episode went live, but I can tell you with 100% certainty that you can find the latest insights to help you navigate the current volatility directly from the homepage on msci.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives.